evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan, South Sudan, and the rest of Africa this Tuesday, January 28, 2025. Another South Sudanese journalist is picked by the country's spy agency.
He said he has coverage work and that he will call me after the work, but he never called back. His phone went off. I was stressed and started sending people to go look for him.
And South Sudanese journalists say the media environment in the country is changing.
If such things happen to one of our colleagues in the media and being arrested like this, the morale of the media personnel will reduce. This is too much risk being a media personnel and challenging.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A former director of the government-owned South Sudan Broadcasting Corporation was picked by men in uniform last week in Juba. The Union of South Sudanese Journalists says Adil Faris is being held by the National Security Service. A spokesman for the spy agency did not admit or deny involvement in the journalist's arrest. For VOA News, Dennis Logonyi reports from Juba.
Adil Faris Mayad, former head of the South Sudan Broadcasting Corporation, a correspondent for Al Jazeera Arabic TV channel and founder of Junubna TV channel, was picked up by men in uniform last week. His wife, Amira Al-Nawi, confirms her husband was detained by unknown people wearing uniforms.
He said he has coverage work and that he will call me after the work, but he never called back. His phone went off. I was stressed and started sending people to go look for him. At the end, someone came and told my sister that some people came and told him to put off his phone and to go with them. But according to the neighbor who spoke to my sister, he said that Adil was taken by the organized forces. They asked him to put off his phone and go with them. Adil requested the soldiers for him to call his wife first, but they refused.
Daniel Majak, Secretary General of the Union of Journalists of South Sudan, condemned the Faris's detention and called on the National Security Service to behave professionally.
Based on our primary investigation, we have learned that it's with national security, and we clearly express our dismay to the national security because the way they are operating now, they are operating like illegal entity when they have the mandate that is given to them by the constitution. So when you have an allegation leveled against somebody, please, if you need him for questioning, please inform his relative, his lawyer, so that people know that he or so-and-so is with the national security.
Solomon, a South Sudan freelance journalist, says Faris's detention is an attack on media freedom in South Sudan.
If such things happen to one of our colleagues in the media and being arrested like this, the morale of the media personnel will reduce. This is too much risk being a media personnel and challenging. Sometimes you want to work freely, but it's not possible due to such obstacles. I wish our government can collaborate with us because we are the fourth pillar of the government. The government should know the role of the media in nation building. They should let us talk and share ideas. Let our colleague, wherever he is, be released. This will show that we are a democratic nation and we uphold democracy.
Several calls and text messages to National Security spokesperson David Komori went unanswered. Majak says the Journalist Union has written to the National Security seeking an explanation for Faris's arrest.
We have already rendered our request to the office of the spokesperson. If we are given a go-ahead, well, if we are not given go-ahead, we will still go to national security uninvited and will request to speak to the spokesperson as well, also speak to the DG, so that we can really understand, because these are the two senior media practitioners now with the national security, Emmanuel Munchol of the DON and him at Adil Faris.
In 2013 and 2014, President Salva Kiir enacted the Media Authority Act, the Broadcasting Corporation Act, and the Rights of Access to Information Act, which constitute the legal framework for the promotion of press freedom and access to information. But these laws have not prevented repeated press freedom violations by the National Security Service. According to the World Press Freedom Index 2024, published by the Paris-based Reporters Without Borders, South Sudan had dropped to 136th position from its ranking of 118th in 2023. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyo reporting from Juba.
Some journalists in South Sudan's capital, Juba, are reacting to the recent arrests of their colleagues. Most of the South Sudanese journalists who spoke to VOA say the media environment in the country has changed. We will come back to that story later. The South Sudan government has lifted the temporary suspension of Facebook and TikTok imposed last week after the circulation of videos depicting the alleged killings of South Sudanese nationals in Sudan. The Director General of the National Communications Authority wrote a letter to telecoms and internet providers Monday, saying the graphic images which triggered violent protests and retaliatory killings across the country have been removed from the social media platforms. President of South Sudan's chapter of Internet Society told VOA that the order banning social media was unnecessary and called on South Sudan's parliament to fast-track enactment of cybersecurity and crimes laws. The prosecutor of the International Criminal Court says his office will be seeking arrest warrants for those accused of atrocities in Sudan's West Darfur. Karim Khan told the UN Security Council Monday that crimes are being committed in Darfur and are being used as a weapon of war.
But as we speak, international crimes are undoubtedly being committed in Darfur. They're being committed as we speak. And daily, unfortunately, we see crimes being used as a weapon of war for so many that the law is meant to protect from these types of excesses. That my office is taking the necessary steps to put forward applications for warrants of arrest in relation to crimes we allege are being committed and have been committed in West Darfur. And I think a simple message, Mr. President, should be understood by those on the ground in Al-Fasha, in Al-Junaina, and across Darfur. Now, better late than never. For goodness sake, comply with international humanitarian law. Not as a charity, not out of some political necessity, but out of the dictates of humanity and black letter law. Last month, I had the honour of appearing with the members of the Darfur Unified Team, presenting closing arguments before the trial chamber of the International Criminal Court in the case of Mr. Ali Mohammed Abdurrahman, also known as Mr. Ali Kusheib. And that trial means an awful lot. That trial focused on crimes allegedly committed between August 2003 and April 2004. And fast forward, one sees similar crimes being committed now. But for Darfuris, this trial means a lot. The same ingredients, the same conditions of threat to international peace and security, and the right of individuals to be seen and to have justice delivered to them is important. And that also requires, Mr. President, concrete action to be taken in relation to the warrant issued by the ICC in relation to former President Omar al-Bashir, Mr. Hussein, and also Mr. Abdurrahman. Now, one can say it's taken too long, and I would agree. And too many lives have been lost, and that's true. But it underlines something very important, that the International Criminal Court is as strong as the support of states.
During the session, Al-Hati Idris Al-Hati Mohammed, Sudan's permanent representative to the United Nations, said Sudan government has cooperated with ICC. He noted, however, that the World Court operates under the principle of legal complementarity, which means Sudan has the first jurisdiction in prosecuting cruel crimes. After the session, Mohammed told journalists that the paramilitary rapid support forces are carrying out 170 attacks on hospitals and infrastructure in Darfur. The Sudan National Army has been battling the RSF for the control of the country for nearly 2 years, creating what the UN calls the world's biggest humanitarian crisis. Sudan plunged into conflict in mid-April 2023 when long simmering tensions between its military and the paramilitary leaders broke out in the capital, Khartoum, and spread to other regions, including West Darfur region. Africa is faced with complex geopolitical developments and economic challenges that are hindering its economic growth. In a meeting held in Nairobi Monday, five heads of state chaired by Kenyan President William Ruto explored institutional reforms for African Union. Experts, however, say such reforms must be led by heads of state and governments and not the AU's secretariat. Maureen Ojiambo reports.
In a meeting held at the State House Nairobi, the African Union addressed the reforms that involved reviving the structure, functioning and focus of the African Union Commission, AU organs and specialized agencies. President William Ruto, who chaired the meeting, said Africa is experiencing unprecedented economic turmoil. Ruto, who also spoke on security matters, said that last April and June, at least 1,000 terror incidences were reported in Africa, with more than 4,000 related deaths. He said that the continent's security apparatus must be strengthened to ensure the safety of its people.
The continent is facing unprecedented challenges regarding peace and security. Conflict continues to rob Africa of its potential, costing the continent an estimated $18 billion annually and displacing millions.
The meeting addressed innovative mechanism for the sustainable financing of the AU, reducing reliance on external donors and ensuring the union's financial independence. Ghanaian President John Dramani Mahama said over-reliance on external partners and funding compromises the organization's independence and ability to set its own agenda.
The AU must streamline its decision-making processes to ensure that they are timely and results-oriented. Bureaucratic inefficiencies undermine the confidence of our citizens and international partners, and overlapping mandates which hinder effective decision-making. By streamlining the AU commissions, clarifying roles, and eliminating redundancies, we can establish a more agile organization that is better equipped to address the evolving needs of our continent.
The member said AU must ensure the set agendas by the union focuses on critical areas, prioritize and streamline the union's agenda, and allocation of resources is key to member states. Tai Selassie is the president of Ethiopia.
Our union can stand on its feet only if we can meet the goals we set to cover 75% of our program budget and 25% of peace support mission. In this connection, we have to advance creative financing, including by encouraging private investment from our continent.
International relations, diplomacy and foreign relations expert Kizito Sabala says the AU reforms are long overdue.
The reform agenda is moving at a very slow pace, partly because it is being driven by the political elites on the continent. One of the major problems on the African continent is that regional integration is not driven by the citizens.
The two-day meeting brought together five selected heads of state and government from the continent. Among those present was also African Union Commission AUC Chairperson Musa Faki. For VOA Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Zimbabwe's freedom fighters are calling on President Emmerson Mnangagwa to step down. Find out why after the break. You You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Some journalists in South Sudan's capital, Juba, are reacting to the recent arrests of their colleagues. Most of the journalists who spoke to VOA say the media environment in the country has changed. Dengai Deng has more from Juba.
Ahmed Albino, a journalist with Juba-based Arabic newspaper Al Mogif, says the detentions of Adel Parez has scared media workers in South Sudan. Parez is the former director of the government-owned South Sudan Broadcasting Corporation. He was recently taken into custody by men in uniform. Albino says the disappearance of a journalist Adel Parez under unclear circumstances is a clear violation of press freedom and society's right to access information. I call on the relevant authorities to reveal the fate of my colleagues Adil and ensure his safety as he was performing his duties as a journalist. It is our responsibility as journalists to stand together in defending freedom of speech and protecting those who risk everything to deliver the truth. Patrick Oyet, the president of the Union of Journalists of South Sudan, says he is being detained by the National Security Service for undisclosed reasons. Oyet condemned the detentions of journalists without due process and the lack of communication with their families.
We call on the National Security Service to expedite its investigation and grant Farris access to his family and lawyer, and adhere to the legal procedures outlined in the Transitional Constitution of South Sudan 2011 as amended, especially Articles 12, 19, and 24, which safeguard liberty, fair trial, and freedom of expression.
Repeated calls to John Kumuri, the NSS spokesperson, for comment when unanswered. Adel Parez's disappearance adds to the ongoing concerns about press freedom in South Sudan. Emmanuel Monchol, editor-in-chief of Juba's daily newspaper, The Dawn, was picked up by the National Security Service last year and is still in the custody. Another journalist in Juba, Atim Simon Mabior, says enforced disappearances violates human rights. Atim says that if there is any charges against an individual, the person could be informed and arraigned in court.
Adel is not attached to any media organization. Recently, he has been just doing his freelancing. He was active on his Facebook page, and even the comments that he gave on his page are things that have nothing to do with any incitement or hate speech or all these things. So we are concerned and we are worried about his whereabouts, and we are asking for more clarification, especially the Minister of Information can help us, and also the relevant authorities, because his family is not here in Juba, they are in Cairo, and they're asking, they wanted to know more about. And as a colleague, so we are asking for immediate release of our colleague Adel Parez, or if there are any charges against him, he can be taken to the court of law, and there he can defend himself or he can be alone. This is
in July 2024, South Sudan's National Legislative Assembly passed amendments to the National Security Service Act, granting authority to arrest and detain individuals without a warrant. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaideng in Juba.
From Juba, we go to Southern Africa, where Zimbabwe's war veterans have called on President Emmerson Mnangagwa to step down after accusing him of nepotism, corruption, and failing to address the economy. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, where he talks to the ruling ZANU-PF party.
At a press conference streamed online, Blessed Runesu Geza, a veteran of Zimbabwe's 1960s and 1970s Liberation War and a member of Zimbabwe Central Committee, called President Emmerson Mnangagwa to step down immediately. He accused Mnangagwa of failing to live up to the promises he made in 2017 when he came to power with the army's help.
He says, we have so many people who died fighting for the liberation of this country. We have no decent graves, which is now being turned into a banana republic by the likes of Emerson while we are watching. People looting fans, the masses struggling while we are like spectators in a country we fought for. So we are saying, as war veterans, enough is enough. We have shown that you have failed. It can't get any worse. Corruption has become a security threat because these people are being protected by Emerson. So as war veterans, including masses, we are being asked, why did you give us this kind of a person? We no longer like him. So we are pleading with you, live peacefully. If you don't, people will use the constitution for you to go, said Geza. In an interview with VOA, ZANU-PF spokesman Farai Marapira dismissed the calls for Mnangagwa to step down.
The party position is clear. The party position is given through clear channels. So we cannot really dignify rogue rantings by responding to them. People speak their mind outside of the party. That's part of democracy, but the party position is clear. We had conference, and that is what we work with. Anything else is just ranting.
At a recent ZANU-PF conference, party leaders passed the resolution that Mnangagwa should seek a third term in 2028, assuming the party can force through amendments to the constitution. In an interview with VOA, Eldred Masunungure, a political professor at the University of Zimbabwe, said the war veterans are feeling genuine frustration as things have not worked out the way they expected after Mnangagwa toppled Robert Mugabe in November 2017.
Political clouds are extremely difficult to read under the circumstances. But what is clear is that they expressed in unambiguous terms their exasperation, you know, with the way things have been going on, you know, in the last couple of years in the Second Republic. So that much is certain. But the outcome of what they are doing, what they are advocating for, what they are campaigning for, that is, in my view, deeply uncertain.
The Second Republic fails to Mnangagwa's presidency after Mugabe's 37 years in power. Brighton Chipamadze is a Harare-based independent political commentator. He says Geza's announcement shows the divisions within the ruling party.
Comrade Geza pointed out during the press conference, there are certain factions or certain individuals benefiting from Mnangagwa's rule, calling for an extension of Mnangagwa's term. Yet there's also a section of the ruling party which is against Mnangagwa extending his term of office.
Zimbabwe's constitution, adopted in 2013, allows parliament to impeach and remove the president if lawmakers feel he's incapacitated. Mnangagwa is one of Africa's oldest heads of state. In 2028, he will be 86 years old. Columbus Mavungam, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
From Zimbabwe, we go to the Democratic Republic of Congo. The United Nations says hundreds of people have been wounded after the M23 rebels advanced on the eastern DRC city. Paul Nantulia, research associate with the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, says to understand the social and political origins of M23, one has to go back to the First and the Second Congo Wars, even the Uganda Civil War, which ended in 1986.
That rebel group is tied into these regional dynamics that go back to that crisis. About a third of the rebels that prosecuted the war in Uganda, Museveni's rebels, were of Rwandese or Rwandan ethnicity. And then there were migrants that had fled Uganda in 1959. So about a third of the manpower of that rebellion came from this group. After Museveni seized power, they rose to very senior positions in the Ugandan military establishment, security establishment, as well as the Uganda government and the intelligence. Then when this group invaded, when the Rwanda Patriotic Front invaded their country in 1991, that manpower came from this group that I have just described. And a lot of those people, essentially the Uganda military lost about a third of its force, but also back to this rebellion. A lot of the people who led the organizations that eventually morphed into M23, some of them were actually part of this. That citizenship has always been at difficult moments in history. In these two countries, that citizenship always comes up for debate, and sometimes it is manipulated for political purposes, which then creates a sense of marginalization and a sense of insecurity, right?
So the this goes back more than a generation.
And the only way to solve it is through political, constitutional, legal, and legislative measures. That has been employed in the DRC as a result of the Sun City Accords, which I participated in. I was working in an organization that was providing technical support to the former Botswana president, Katumila Masire. And one of the elements of the Sun City Accords is precisely this nationality question and how to address and how to pacify the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo by finding a permanent solution to the problem of the citizenship of the Congolese of Rwandan ethnicity. And by the way, they're not just Tutsis. These are Tutsis, Hutus, and Twa. So when we talk about the Banyamulenge, which is the Banyamulenge, these are Congolese of Rwandan ethnicity. No, no, they're not just Tutsi. They are Tutsi, Hutu, and Twa. So essentially, the M23 has actually grown in scope.
When you were talking about those accords, what happened with those accords when they were trying to reach a peace agreement before, years ago?
The accords were actually successful. I mean, in my opinion, as somebody who was involved with them from day one up to the signing. And they were successful in the sense that they gave Congo a chance, right? The 2006 election, which was the first election that Congo had since independence, were held under the aegis of these accords. And then you had a parliament that was set up. You had a government of national unity. You had a security sector reform that included all elements of the Congolese population and so on. And then you also had the Lusaka peace process. The Lusaka peace process was designed to address the external element of the crisis. So you had Rwanda, Uganda, and Burundi that were supporting the rebellion. And then you had Southern African countries like Angola, there was Namibia, there was Zimbabwe, right, that was supporting the Congolese government.
What is the answer for trying to, address their grievances?
The problem is not the framework. The problem is the political will. So right now we have a situation where the relationship between the Rwandan president and the Congolese president is at an all-time low, to such an extent that they're actually even trading insults. And this is something that we've not seen before. The militias that are supporting the Democratic Republic of Congo government seem to have made the calculation that international pressure just does not apply, and they're not going to bend to international pressure. So
does that mean that we're possibly looking at a regional conflict, a wider regional conflict?
We are potentially looking at a wider regional conflict, because already yesterday we saw some artillery shelling from the DRC side, on Rwandan territory.
That's Paul Nantulia, research associate with the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam. Oh, that's all we prepared for you this Tuesday, January 28, 2024. We now leave you with Emmy J. Yore and the song Asogoro.
Be a
have been listening to Emmy J. Yore and the song Asogoro. Asogoro means haters, or what you will call enemies of progress. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live progress, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 in Washington. For more information on our programs, log on to www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Jumbe Hamza, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America. America.